Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Baby on the Fire Escape, Creativity, Motherhood, and the Mind-Baby Problem by Julie Phillips, narrated by Marnie Young. The Mind-Baby Problem. The maternal subject is a figure that disrupts or interrupts our notions of subjectivity. Lisa Beretzer. I insist that motherhood is an undiscovered country in the literary sense, one we must venture into lest our experience go unrecorded. Sarah Rule. Picture an artist or writer at work, and you probably imagine sustained solitary concentration. Proust scribbling in bed in his cork-lined room, Yeats descending from his tower, encountering his two children and asking, "Who are they?" Wittgenstein, who is said to have eaten nothing but Swiss cheese sandwiches for weeks on end, because even changes in the flavor of his food disturbed his thoughts. The artist may be in the midst of family life, but obsessively at work, like Henri Matisse, whose painting pulled him in like a vortex. He could think of nothing else, his daughter said. The creator may be an art monster, Jenny Offel's term for the creator who lives only for the work. The great writer may be a detached observer, a flaneur, soaking up scenes of city life. If natural beauty is his subject, he may write alone in a cabin in the woods or wander, lonely as a cloud, enjoying the bliss of solitude. She may agree with the poet of Mary Oliver that creative work needs solitude. It needs concentration. It needs the whole sky to fly in, and no eye-watching. Or with Gertrude Stein, who warned, "It takes a lot of time to be a genius. You have to sit around so much doing nothing, really doing nothing." A typical picture of a woman with children is of someone whose children are constantly breaking in. Perhaps she has shut herself into a room to write. Her kids have promised not to knock or to make noise, but she knows they are there, because they are lying down and breathing under the door. Adrienne Rich longed in vain amid the discontinuity of female life with its attention to small chores, for the freedom to press on, to enter the currents of thought like a glider pilot, knowing that your emotion can be sustained, that the buoyancy of your attention will not be suddenly snatched away. Alice Walker saw her daughter in her mind's eye as she worked, the lonely sucking of her thumb, a giant stopper in my throat. In place of the solitary flaneur, imagine Naomi Mitchison in a London park, writing on a board balanced on her pram. Think of Shirley Jackson making plot notes in the kitchen while dinner was on the stove. Toni Morrison driving to work with a pad of paper in the car, so that she could write whenever the traffic slowed. Here, the act of writing is not continuous but provisional, contingent, subject to disruption. And yet the words are still coming, and the work is getting done. The division between mothering and creative work once seemed more or less absolute. Sylvia Plath feared that a woman must sacrifice all claims to femininity and family to be a writer. Tilly Olson wrote, "In the 20 years I bore and reared my children, the simplest circumstances for creation did not exist." It was a physical problem, a time problem. It was also a question of selfhood. The obligation to be physically attractive and patient and nurturing and docile and sensitive and deferential contradicts and must collide with the egocentricity and aggressiveness and the indifference to self that a large creative gift requires in order to flourish. Susan Sontag said, overstating things as usual, but the expectation that women, more than men even now, should be ever present for their children does compete with creative selfhood. Sometimes mothers had trouble giving themselves permission. Alice Neal said that until she received a major retrospective in her 70s, "I had always felt, in a sense, that I didn't have a right to paint, because I had two sons and had so many things I should be doing, and here I was painting." Sometimes the judgment came from others. Neal's in-laws claimed, on no evidence, that she had once left her baby on the fire escape of her New York apartment when she was trying to finish a painting. It's a vivid image of the dangers, in their mind, of trying to do two things at once. Maternal bliss conspires with maternal guilt to erode creative work. Margaret Mead, "It's not because the baby cries, but because the baby smiles so much. that the hours get lost. Jenny Offill, the love you feel for your child has a way of obliterating whatever you used to think you loved. In 1962, Olson could still state that almost no mothers or any other part-time, part-self persons had written books that would endure. But in or about that same year, the careers of women with children were beginning to flourish, not just in ones and twos, but in numbers big enough to matter. Mothers found ways to do their work and were recognized for it. Doris Lessing won the Nobel Prize. Ursula K. Le Guin was awarded the National Book Medal, America's highest literary honor. Alice Walker won a Pulitzer and sold millions. Audre Lorde opened a conversation around intersectionality. Angela Carter was acknowledged as one of the defining literary voices of 20th century Britain, and Susan Sontag as one of the great English language critics. Alice Neal saw her art accepted into the canon. I've tried in this book to trace the course of that change. I've tried to find out what mothering plus creativity looks like, not just in the first few years, but as a part of a life story. What does it mean to create, not alone in a room of one's own, but in a shared space? What kinds of work have come out of that space? What is the shape of a creative mother's life? This was my plan, to explore the blank spot on the map where mothering and creativity converge. I had never been able to convey the full power of my own life as a mother. I remember how empty even the simple sentence, "I have two children," felt in comparison to the experience, as though I was recounting a dream that made no sense in daylight. Because I didn't have words, I wanted others to speak for me. In investigating the lives of great women, I hoped to see my own experience with new eyes. That blank spot should have told me something. The more I read and wrote, the more the place where mothering and creative work come together seemed not to be an intersection of identities, but a negative space, an impossible position. I read brilliant first-person accounts of mothering, but couldn't see patterns or a path. The stories of my subjects' lives as mothers wouldn't hang together. When I looked at the work, the mothering vanished, and vice versa. When I read essays, memoirs, and stories, I found contradictions, fragments, anecdotes, scraps of enlightenment. I encountered what psychoanalytic theorist Lisa Beretzer calls the intractable problem of how intellectuals and maternal labor appear to cancel one another out. Parenting affects and is affected by each person's circumstances and is affected too by race, resources, sexuality, family relationships, disability. Not all mothers have given birth. Not all end up raising their children. The women I wanted to write about came to mothering by different paths, did or didn't have a partner, were older or younger, had more or less money and support. They became pregnant by accident or by choice, fostered a teenager, confronted infertility, lost a child. They admitted anger and pain, rejected stereotypes, superwoman, angel in the house, explored maternal ambivalence. But where is mother's creative self? Do mothers have inner lives? What is the subjective experience of being a mother? And why, despite a steadily growing body of writing on the phenomenology of mothering, does it still seem, on a deeper level, so unnarratable, undramatic, everywhere in practice, but in theory nowhere? I started saying I was exploring maternal subjectivity. That got some people's attention, especially academics. Or at least it didn't make their eyes glaze over the way "I'm writing about mothers" did. Proposing mother as a subject position surprises people, and it also, on the evidence, baffles them. Over and over again, my friends forget the subject of my book, until I started to wonder if my blank space on the map was unthinkable, beyond memory. Searching for a theory of motherhood that might make my narrative hang together, I investigated psychoanalysis. It was like looking at the Bruegel painting of the Fall of Icarus. In the foreground, children grow and develop, while off in the distance, the mother as a person with a narrative of her own disappears from view. Psychoanalysis focuses so intently on the child's development that the mother, in her paradoxical state, created by the child but existing apart from it, can never be the central character. The psychoanalytic insistence on the Oedipal drama as the origin of both creativity and the self relegates the mother not only to a supporting role, but to a predetermined one. Both essentialism and normativity loom large. In thinking about mother love, Baratzer writes, and our need to maintain a fantasy of maternal love as a given suffuses a huge variety of psychological discourses. The Freudian view, as Susan Sontag observed, to her annoyance, while she was ghostwriting her husband's book on Freud's influence, was that mothering was the end of growth and achievement for a woman. As a mother, she merely assumed her natural role. By the time a woman is 30, Freud claimed, her psyche has taken up its final positions, and there are no paths open to her for further development. If anything, she relinquishes her independent self entirely. The early analyst Alice Balint wrote in 1939 that the ideal situation was one in which the interests of mother and child are identical. More reassuring to creative women is the idea that one can be a good enough mother. This was the term the psychiatrist D.W. Winnicott used in describing a mother-child relationship that is healthy and nurturing, despite the mother's less-than-complete attention to the baby. Good enough is useful in dismissing the demands of attachment to parenting and other attempts to move the goalposts of maternal devotion. But good enough for whom? In this model, it's still the child's needs, not the mother's, that are being met, and the mother remains, in Baratzer's words, the impossible subject par excellence, a shadowy figure who seems to disappear from the many discourses that explicitly try to account for her. My sexuality and gender can be theorized as social and historical constructs. My vocation as a writer may originate in my childhood experience, but what about my relationship to my child and to myself as a mother? Am I supposed to put a fence around that and call it a theory-free zone? Is it true that the mother is, as the French feminists have suggested, unspeakable in a phallocentric tongue? Maggie Nelson writes that she rejects the quarantining of the feminine or the maternal from the realm of intellectual profundity. But she also quotes the poet Alice Notley on her new baby. He is born, and I am undone. Feel as if I will. Never be, was never born. Playwright Sarah Rule, looking at the lack of mothers as protagonists, wonders if the experience of motherhood is unstageable, beyond narrative and language. Then she worries that the experience is tellable, but no one wants to see it. Mothers aren't meant to have points of view. In her memoir, A Life's Work, Rachel Cusk comments that the experience of motherhood loses nearly everything in its translation to the outside world. In motherhood, a woman exchanges her public significance for a range of private meanings, and like sounds outside a certain range, they can be very difficult for other people to identify. In queer theory, mothers are too heteronormative, while African-American writing emphasizes the primacy of mothers, but often in a context of community building rather than individual creative agency. You might think that the parenting of infants is simply too low in status, too abject, too deep in what Plath called the stink of fat and baby crap for theoretical interest. But that can't be the real problem, since even bodily waste has been a site of critical thought, though when I page through the French theorist Dominique Laporte's tongue-in-cheek Histoire de la merde, I find that even he has left out the most poop-stained of all human relationships, the parent-infant bond. Nonetheless, diapers challenge drama. When my kids were small, I went out in the evening to see the conclusion of the Lord of the Rings trilogy in a movie theater. Wiping a bottom the next morning, I felt my elated identification with the future ruler of Middle-earth ebbing away. I'd been banished from epic into low comedy. I wasn't the hero of the story. I was one of Monty Python's peasants saying, "How did you know he's the king? He hasn't got shit all over him." Many writers almost reflexively protect the mother-child space, conspiring to keep it unexamined. This might be a question of the child's privacy. Mom, you're embarrassing me. Or one's own inadmissible feelings. It might be lack of distance. Sarah Manguso asks, is it possible to truly observe one's own child, as a writer must, while also simultaneously loving him? Does a mother have something like writer's block? Perceiver's block? Feminist psychoanalyst Julia Kristeva sees mother love as an escape from representation, and its unrepresentability as its subversive power. In her famous essay, Stabat Mater, she calls mothering a catastrophe of identity that casts the self into that unnameable that somehow involves our imaginary representations of femininity, non-language, or the body. This relegation to the unnameable feels not far removed from Le Guin's cynical observation that to become a wife and mother is to turn into a nobody. I find that unsatisfying, another mythification. I can't believe that mothering is beyond representation. I think making mothers mysterious is another way of keeping them unacknowledged. It also sounds like one of my kids complaining that they can't find their favorite shirt. Where have you looked? Have you tried looking harder? When writers and artists describe their experience of mothering, they often use the word divided. Louise Erdrich muses that parents live and work with a divided consciousness, that is, uncomfortably close to self-erasure. Rachel Cusk describes being torn away from a conversation to console a crying baby as being split in two, like a divided stream. The person and the mother pay each other no heed, although moments earlier they were indistinguishable. They tumble forwards, each with its separate life. Sometimes it feels more like disintegration. When Afil became a mother, she felt like a bomb had gone off in her life. Devoted to the needs of a small baby, Gwendolyn Brooks couldn't call my soul my own. Maritzer writes that mothering is complicated by the constant attack on narrative that the child performs, literally breaking into maternal speech, as well as the mother's own self-narrative, which is punctured at the level of constant interruptions to thinking, reflecting, sleeping, moving, and completing tasks. What is left is a series of unconnected experiences that remain fundamentally unable to cohere. In Maternal Encounters, The Ethics of Interruption, Maritzer speculates that to be a parent is to have a subjectivity that is shared, impinged on, that has to budge up to make room for a radically unpredictable other. When she became a mother, she felt chained to her child, unable to finish a sentence, think, or sleep, lost her sense of being agile, capable, quick, self-reflective. As she explored this new state, new ways of seeing emerged. The child's relentlessly unpredictable and extreme presence forced her into an appreciation of experiences she had skimmed over before. She felt heightened sentience, a renewed awareness of objects, of one's own emotional range and emotional robustness, a renewed encounter with oneself as a speaking subject. Instead of wishing for more coherence, Maritzer looks at what could be gained from embracing a shared self. Against the solitary writer in the tower, she places a subjectivity that, itself interrupted, is alert to the questions that interruption asks of normal life. Against the figure of the flaneur, she offers the mother engaged in parental parkour, practicing the extreme sport of getting a full-loaded stroller over curbs and up and down flights of stairs. She invites us to look at whether this struggle with maternal stuff, in an environment that the mother rediscovers through perpetual navigation, might in its own way be generative. In fact, Maritzer argues, psychoanalytic theory has been saying for some time now that the unified self is an illusion. To recognize that well-boundaried self as a retrospective fantasy, rather than an indispensable writing aid, might help writers and artists cope with the attack on narrative that they suffer in caring for a child. Like Afil, who sought to capture this new fractured consciousness on the page, Manguso wrote her memoir of motherhood as an assemblage of already exploded bits that cohere anyway, a reminder that what seems a violent interruption seldom is. Sarah Rule writes, "There was a time when I first found out I was pregnant with twins that I saw only a state of conflict. When I looked at the theater in parenthood, I saw only war, competing loyalties, and I thought my writing life was over. There were times when it felt as though my children were annihilating me. And finally, I came to the thought, all right then, annihilate me. That other self was a fiction anyhow. And then I could breathe. I could investigate the pauses." In accepting interruption, she was able to recollect herself and recover her artistic agency. "I'm drawn to this image of interruption in part because of my own sense as I've worked on this book, that I can't get it together. The stories of the artist and the mother exist side by side, occasionally breaking into or commenting on each other, but more often stubbornly refusing to be one thing. Writing and mothering seem to turn away from each other, thematically speaking, and the practical, real-life divisions between work and parenting run right down the middle of my text. But maybe the stories aren't meant to come together, if it's so hard to move beyond anecdote and discord onto some higher plane of maternal theorizing. Maybe it's because the interruptions are what I'm meant to be noticing. Perhaps interruption and disruption are not what keep me from seeing mothering clearly, but are the conditions of maternal creativity. The second-wave feminists hope that gender equality would resolve all the practical and emotional contradictions of writing and mothering. This is Lessing's dream of a golden notebook, the one that would join the separate narrative strands of a woman's life. It is Hélène Cixous' image of women writing in the white ink of the maternal body, as if nursing an idea and a baby were the same, and not two different acts done sequentially or simultaneously by the same body and mind. It is Adrienne Rich writing wistfully. There must be ways in which the energy of creation and the energy of relation can be united. In this narrative, the problem is interruption, whether by children, guilt, or self-doubt, and the resolution is harmony. But as I look at mothers' lives, I think these visions may not do justice to the actual maternal creative process, which, alongside periods of harmony, seems to involve foregrounding disruptions, leaping across gaps, piecing together careers, and other provisional and drastic measures. The frustration and pleasure that writer-mothers experience seems better expressed with images of improvisation and compromise than of multiple selves in amicable concord. If Rich's energies of creation and relation can't be united, parents can still hold them in a sometimes frustrating, sometimes generative balance. Rule compares the balance to a heartbeat, the great systole and diastole of work and children. This is the baby on the fire escape, not the slanderous story, but the reality that it stands for, the precarious situation in which the child is just far enough out of sight and mind for the mother to have a talk with her muse. It's the mental and temporal distance that an artist or writer needs to place between herself and her children so she can have the presence, the permission, the little sips of selfhood, Natasha Randall, that sustain creativity. It's keeping and letting go. It's art and care going on at once, for a moment, a day, a lifetime. Interruption was a clue, but still I felt like the more I read about mothering, the less I knew. Maternity often seems to be all description and no story. For many parental sensations that aren't even words, my thesaurus lists dozens of synonyms for depression, love, and even tedium, but has no word for the state of boredom, alienation, and adoration induced by playing a game with a one-year-old, or the after-hours cocktail of exhaustion, fury, and addled romance served up by night-waking. The term maternal ambivalence doesn't evoke the full flavor, though C.N. Nye's term stuplimity for what is both sublime and stupefying might come close. Fragment and anecdote appear to be the default modes of speaking, partly because, as Baratzer observes, they're what survives children's interruptions, their attack on narrative, partly because they allow vital information to be disassembled and smuggled out from behind the barrier of love that, ideally, shields kids from the world. Ursula Le Guin corresponded with a childless friend who asked her regularly what mothering was like. Ursula would answer that she had cried during her eldest daughter's cello recital, or mention that with Christmas coming and her son homesick, she planned to spend the day cutting out paper ornaments and getting glitter in the rug. It's all maternal praxis, raw material for a phenomenology of mothering. It was this quality of lived experience that I wanted to get at when I first thought of writing about mothering biographically. I wanted to describe whole lives in which mothering was a part, and in writing about my subjects' lives, I've tried to honor the anecdotal quality and to keep an eye on the role that interruption plays. But interruption didn't give me a story. It lacks the dimension of time, the biographer's thread through the labyrinth. Freud thought a woman who became a mother had come to the end of her story. Anne Enright thought that after the birth of her child she had found a place before story start. I realized that if I wanted to put up a counter-image to the solitary writer, it would have to allow not only interruption, but change. 20th-century mothers' stories were shaped and constrained by a common narrative I thought of as the motherhood plot. As feminist biographers, including Phyllis Rose and Carolyn Heilbrunn, have pointed out, most people live their lives according to the stories they are offered by history and convention. For women, getting married and having children has been that story. In the motherhood plot, a traditional marriage and children are a woman's achievement, the aim of her life's adventure, her means of economic survival and promise of emotional sustenance. It was astonishingly difficult for the women I wrote about not to follow the motherhood plot. Their reasons were individual, but the outcome kept being the same. They married for love, like Alice Neal, or to get out of the house, like Angela Carter. They were looking for financial support or creative collaboration, so they wouldn't feel so artistically alone. They married, like Doris Lessing, to fill the empty space where their fate should be. They had children because that was what married women did, or because a pregnancy made their choice for them. Middle-class parents felt stifled by the work of maintenance, while poor women and women of color struggled to keep their children fed and safe in a world that didn't welcome their coming. The African-American motherhood plot emphasized strength, ingenuity, and financial independence, but also selflessness, suffering, and endurance. Black mothering under white supremacy, which has often involved the additional work of caring for white mothers' children, has brought with it an extra burden of resistance. Danny McLean writes, "If we merely accept the status quo and fail to challenge the forces that have kept black people and women oppressed, then we participated in our own and our children's destruction." For almost all women, the motherhood plot was what happened if you were not living your life with intention, or if you didn't know what your options were. In Lesbian Nation, Jill Johnston called her marriage and two children the illusory solution to a problem I didn't know was much bigger than me. I didn't know what else to do, and marriage was always a thing to do, in fact, a basic thing to do. It was all around you. In her great exploration of motherhood, of woman born, Adrienne Rich said of herself in the family-centered 1950s, "I had no idea of what I wanted, what I could or could not choose. I only knew that to have a child was to assume adult womanhood to the full, to prove myself, to be like other women." The motherhood plot is compelling partly because, in the right circumstances, love of partner and children can be a powerful source of joy, support, freedom, and strength. Toni Morrison said that becoming a mother was the most liberating thing that ever happened to me. I could not only be me, whatever that was, but somebody actually needed me to be that. Ursula Le Guin found in marriage and children a stability that allowed her to work. Mother love can be revolutionary, particularly for poor and marginalized women fighting for time and space to care for their children. Alexis Pauline Gumbs writes, "The radical potential of the word mother comes after the M. It is the space that other takes in their mouths when we say it. We are something else. We know it from how fearfully institutions wield social norms and try to shut us down." Poet Christy Nemi Erickson adds, "A brown mother's love is her biggest protest." But the motherhood plot makes no provision for the creative self. If anything, it insists on selflessness, not only toward babies and children, but toward husbands, partners, and others. For a while, divorced with two small children, Morrison lost herself. "I was somebody's parent, somebody's this, somebody's that, but there was no me in this world." Enright writes, "Babies demand your entire self, but it is a funny kind of self. It is a mixture of the all a factory worker gives to the conveyor belt and the all a lover offers to the one he adores. It involves, on both counts, a fair degree of self-abnegation. This is why people who mind children suffer from despair. It happens all of a sudden. They realize, all of a sudden, that they still exist." Most of the women in this book started out following the motherhood plot. All of them contended with it. All of them left it. When they ran off the cliff and found themselves in midair, when they felt knocked sideways by love, relegated to the margins of their own lives, When they found themselves storyless, they had to improv.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?